God to the skeptic, God to the sinner, God to the saint. Voltaire, speaking of skeptics, he famously remarked that if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. At the same Voltaire, less famously confessed that all nature cries out that he must exist. So here at this point, we are not yet concerned to distinguish between the atheistic and agnostic positions. Much less are we going to elaborate on all the diverse species of agnosticism. We're going to do that next week. We're going to talk about acognosticism and ignosticism and other forms of intellectual cop-outs, which is what they are. But that'll be next week. Here, we're just introducing how the Christian theist understands skepticism or disbelief as such. In a sense, all we're going to be doing is defining and unpacking these concepts as the lenses of approach. What is skepticism? Is skepticism purely and simply a never-ending series of questions? In his book, Skepticism and Animal Faith, the American philosopher George Santayana, this is in 1923, Santayana made this claim. He said, skepticism is a suspicion of error about facts. And to suspect error about facts is to share the enterprise of knowledge, in which facts are presupposed and error is possible. Skepticism is accordingly a form of belief. Dogma cannot be abandoned. It can only be revised in view of some more elementary dogma, which it has not yet occurred to the skeptic to doubt. So, what Santayana is saying there is that skepticism, really, in a sane form, is dogma turned outward against competing dogmas. Skepticism is not a skepticism of dogmas. It pretends to be at times, if the person is just not thinking about the floor that he's standing on. Skepticism is dogma turned outward against other competing dogmas. It's a suspicion about facts because of facts. I doubt that that thing is that way because. No, I just don't have a cause for it. Okay, that's not very much of a skepticism then. Why should I join you in your bandwagon of uncertainty if you don't have a reason for which you believe that thing is not likely to be true? So in other words, the atheist and the agnostic have something in common here. Intellectually, according to the scriptures, the atheist and agnostic have something in common. Both are mishandling the invisible things of God that they do have access to. So let me draw that out. And I'll keep that verse up there in Romans 1, 18, 32. We're about to visit it. But what we're looking at here is the world in which the individual exists is a world full of facts. The skeptic depends on these facts to make his arguments. And what the Apostle Paul is going to say is that the atheist and agnostic have something in common here. They have facts out here, and I'm going to put the word facts underneath his feet as well to make the same point. Facts about goodness, beauty, power, wisdom, order, design, knowledge, infinity, immutability. A bunch of things that are not finite. And his whole argument depends on these things. The only difference between the agnostic and atheist is that one claims to know how such things cannot possibly be, that's the atheist, while the other claims that we can't, or at least we don't, know how such things can be. So it's two different opposite sides of the coin, but there's a coin there. The one focuses on the divine object being incoherent, that's the atheist, the other on the human subject being too little to really get his heads up out of this subject. That's the agnostic. But whatever their emphasis are, whatever their difference, both the agnostic and the atheist dogmas depend upon a real knowledge about what various attributes of God must be like in order to deny their possibility or to deny our access to them. So let me just preview weeks 2 and 3 by pointing out a fact that should be obvious, but it gets missed every time. The atheist and the agnostic, their whole argument depends upon attributes that are infinite and unchanging. In order to show you how such attributes can't be the case at all, or can't be the case in relationship to this world. Hold on to that, because in weeks 2 or 3 you might have this aha moment that makes you realize, wait a minute, atheism and agnosticism depend upon theism in order to exist. And that's exactly right. The Christian sees in both of these claims something that is forced and temporary. The claims of the agnostic and the atheist are forced because they always ignore either what the divine attribute in question says about itself or the sense in which the attribute exemplifies some other relevant divine attribute. So in either case, the objections are always straw men, and we're going to see that clearly. These claims are also temporary, because both the atheist and the agnostic need the divine attributes to exist in order to attribute anything to them as the object of their attack. So, and I would also say that they need these things to exist in order to criticize other things and talk about other things that exist every day. For example, just a popular example, Karl Marx, at the beginning of the Communist Manifesto, when he basically said that up until this point in history, there is nothing but class warfare, etc., etc., and that's not such a bad thing, it just happens to annoy me. Join me on my bandwagon of uncertainty. Marx didn't say that. For one thing, because his book wouldn't have sold many copies if he said that. What was he implying? This class conflict, or at least their role in it, is bad. Bad? What is that? Well, it's not good. What is that? Something up here. Every time the atheist and agnostic opens his mouth, nothing comes out but attributes of God. Human language is nothing but the communication, either essentially or corrupt, of the divine attributes. And that is Paul's point. We will get to Paul. For now, let's go with a couple of modern voices. Ludwig Feuerbach. Feuerbach was a materialist. His dates are 1804 to 1872. You don't have to know that. But he's interesting because he proposed a materialism that was foundational for Sigmund Freud's explanation of the God idea. Where do I draw this? Well, that's what the Christian has in history. Let's have another board to resurrect the atheist idea. Here's the individual in nature. In Feuerbach's idea, the emphasis is going to be out from man. With Freud, the emphasis is going to be these things pressing in on us. In addition, so Freud also agreed with Feuerbach there. First, Feuerbach. In his mind, the idea of God is the psychological or mental extrapolation of things that we are into this super-me. Let's call him super-me. Super-Matt. In other words, I'm pretty good. There's an infinite goodness. I'm pretty wise. I know what I'm doing. But there, I can imagine a being who has all wisdom. I'd like to have that. I'm pretty powerful. I can move this over there more so than a child or an animal or an inanimate object. I can imagine a power that has the superlative dimensions of all these different things. And this is what Feuerbach's getting at. We invented God as a mental extrapolation of our own psyche. Well, Freud dug deeper into that for poetic effect. And what he basically said is that we see these dangers. And we experience these fears. So not only was he looking at these base instincts in here, but there's these things pressing in us, natural disasters and so on. And so we invent religion, starting at animism, where objects become these deities, and then polytheism, because of course we want to assign a really powerful being to all the most dangerous things. And of course, the more dangerous an object is, the bigger that god will be up on the totem pole. So there'll be this god of wind and god of storms and god of diseases and god of warfare. Will appease those gods and we'll make these things personal. Because if we make these things personal, if we understand these things personal, then we can deal with them. If they're not personal, they're fearsome. And so what Freud was saying is that if we personalize the most dangerous things, now what do you need to do? What's even better than that? Why don't we just consolidate all of these forces and make them into one being who is orderly and in charge of everything? Thus you move from animism to polytheism, to monotheism. By the way, Freud did not invent that idea. That was already out there at the early 19th century and even earlier than that. Now, he derives this from Feuerbach's materialism a generation earlier. Feuerbach was assuming a philosophy even behind him, of Immanuel Kant. Because the whole continent had been shifted by Kant's idea that up here, you have things like eternal truths, and down here, you have material, you have phenomena. So what I'm going to do here is to put the individual here. And what happened in continental thought following Kant is that the only thing that you could talk about were these objects of the subject. In other words, consciousness. These categories of your mind that created the world, and what's happening there is an individual has nothing to talk about but what he projects. Schopenhauer, after Kant, called this the world as will and representation. So naturally, the only thing Feuerbach had to point to when he looked at religion is stuff in himself, projected out on nature. These things are not clever ideas that they come up with, they're just the next step in that train of thought in Western thought. Now, oh, that's evil. Cell phones are evil. I'm getting cocky because it hasn't done that in a long time. So I just leave it on now. Evil. Well, let me read you something from the Psalms, because I think the psalmist is much more sophisticated than Feuerbach in this concept of projection. Because what really they're saying here, here's the nuts and bolts of it. Forget about where it came from for a second. If I buy this argument, then when I see finite things down here, my mind projects the infinite from the finite. So let's just boil it down to the most essential thing. For Feuerbach or Freud, what this would amount to is that the mind of man projects from the finite to the infinite. I'm going to read you something from the Psalms that's very familiar to you, and actually, along with Romans 1:20, starts to formulate our doctrine of general revelation. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." Now, obviously, there's poetic language being used there, but what is he ultimately saying? There isn't anything you can look at, anything. See these finite X's down here? There isn't anything you can look at that does not speak about one thing. And he uses this one thing he calls the glory of God. But shorthand, there is no finite speech, symbol, object, interpretation that does not speak this singular voice of the infinite. The question I want to ask is, whose view is more sophisticated at this point? Think about these infinite things: being, cause, truth, goodness, design, all transcendent things. Things that cannot be explained by any finite thing. Yet they're indispensable for talking about any finite thing. In other words, you're not even talking about God, you're talking about a stick. You need to talk in these terms, these transcendent terms. This language of God's glory, as the psalmist calls it, is in every finite thing. Each finite thing exemplifies a touch of infinity. And since infinity is uncaused, and the finite by definition came into existence, then it seems much more rational to place the burden of proof on the one who wants to argue that the finite is more real than the infinite. In other words, you have two claims here. One is that the infinite, which is uncaused, remember, is the projection of the finite. The other says that the finite is a projection of the infinite. Which one squares with the law of cause and effect? Which one squares with the very definition of those words, infinite and finite? The psalmist's concept of projection here is much more sophisticated and rational than Feuerbach or Freud. It passes the test of logic, theirs doesn't. The Bible actually gives a very simple but very good reason why it's so easy to reject the notion of God. The Bible's not claiming that because this voice is everywhere, this hearing's everywhere, perfectly the same. The Bible doesn't claim that. The Bible claims the very opposite. That though this knowledge is so clear, yet everybody is running in the other direction. Now, this reason the Bible gives is such a good, simple reason that it's even used by skeptics in their argument. They simply repeat the same thing as if they said something profoundly damaging and surprising to the theist. And that is the plain fact that God is invisible and man lives in the visible. And the unspoken assumption there is that the invisible is going to be a kind of embarrassment to us, like in the adjective for my invisible friend. And so we have to defend this invisible thing, and they've got the substantive thing, things like that. I think that's the unspoken assumption. Yet the invisible is something that we all assume every day to think about things which are visible. And yet in doing so, we're training our mind on invisible things, and that's actually very difficult business. Mathematics, grammar, our emotions, our relational knowledge. In other words, when we talk about anything in relation to something else, we actually break down the words are actually all about invisible things. And we talked about that in the philosophy class, why that is. And at first it's like, huh? What are you talking about? Everything's about a visible thing. The things are visible. And you actually break down the sentence and the grammar of it. You're like, huh? Never thought about that. That's right, because it's harder to think about the invisible things. The reason the invisible is so hard, as it turns out, is not because it's so unreal, but because of how much more sophisticated it is than this fluxing visible realm. Now, that doesn't mean that studying the visible realm is unsophisticated. Think of science as an example. But you'll notice that when the scientist is doing his study, here's his lab table. And that works by induction. I mean just the lab table. We've gotten the idea that all science works by induction. It does not. And even secular scientists have proven that out. So you have assumptions. You have paradigms, represented by the line here. And you have interpretation, none of which is visible. What goes on in that lab table is visible, but everything that upholds science and flows from science is basically invisible. In other words, the visible realm as an end in itself is the ABCs of rationality. It's all very understandable and necessary and easy to control, but as a destination, as an end in itself, it's fit only for animals and early childhood development. That's why C.S. Lewis called atheism little boy's philosophy. Because its picture of the world is too simple. It's an account of motion that stops at animal level description, at grunts and waves that are beneath the dignity of even the physical sciences. Now, the scripture talks like this. The way I'm pointing this out now, the scripture talks like this, not with mocking tones, but it has to make the point in a very matter-of-fact way. So, Psalm 14:1, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 53:1 repeats the same thing. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Heart in the Hebrew, by the way, means the whole soul. And so the idea is you have this holistic being. It's not the mind as a computer board just taking an input dispassionately and stuff like that. The fool says in his whole being, there is no God. Psalm 10:4. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Almost like he's clicking his heels together and saying it again and again, and there is no God, there is no God, say there is no God. The unbeliever, in other words, believes in unbelief. He has to work hard at this, because everything he says or thinks depends upon the existence of God, and it's driving him mad. So there's a connection in these passages, the passages we're going to keep looking at, and the heart that it calls pride, and the practical outworking of that, which is unbelief. This unbelief is forced, and to a certain extent, we can say that it's made up. So, I don't know if you have a Bible on you, but I'm going to read you an extended passage from Romans chapter 1. This is the one I was talking about. This is Paul giving, I think, the most definitive treatment of how this works. Romans chapter 1, I'm just going to read 18 through 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Those are key words. Suppress the truth. By the way, the word for suppress in the Greek, katakein, literally means locked up or incarcerate. It's a very active and organized action. For what can be known about God, Paul says, is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. Listen to this language. Listen to this claim. I think the modern church, the only thing we think is that is hard to believe is all the dumb things the church does that create stumbling blocks for people to believe. In other words, if the church wasn't so darn irrelevant or backward, people would just be falling over themselves in their search for God. But Paul's saying, the knowledge of God has been clearly perceived since the beginning of the world, in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. That's a strong claim. The knowledge of God is so clear to every single person that they are legally guilty if they neglect it. They are without excuse. And he finishes by saying in verse 21, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now, none of this means that the Christian is not committed to the position that skepticism is real. The Christian is not saying, Paul is not saying, that therefore ignorance is not real ignorance. Questions are not real questions. That's not what he's saying. The moral problem and the intellectual problem perpetuate each other. Just like if you're in a dark room, you're going to step on something. And if you step on something, you'll be less likely to get to the switch. And if you get it. It perpetuates itself. There's both. Darkness begets deception, which deception begets more darkness. Paul wrote to the Ephesians in Ephesians 4, 17 and 18, that you Christians, must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardness of their hearts. Do you see all the because of language in that verse? Don't walk as them who can't figure out where they're going because they're in darkness, because the ignorance is in them, because of the hardness of heart. The moral problem begets more of an intellectual problem. The intellectual problem begets more of a moral problem. The Bible, in these verses, is teaching three things, at least. That the person who denies God's existence is A, foolish, B, lying, and C, motivated by his pursuit of sin. Let me say that again. The Bible's teaching in these verses that the person who denies God's existence is A, foolish, B, full of it, and C, motivated by his pursuit of sin. And since this motive of the heart is driving the mind once a man, or, by the way, is this a foreign idea to the atheist? Not at all. What did Richard Dawkins say about the creationist? If anybody doesn't believe evolution, he is either wicked or stupid. Or, sorry, he put stupid before wicked, because wicked, he didn't want to consider that. Why, Richard? Maybe because the opposite of wicked is something that you don't believe exists? It might be one reason why he didn't want to consider that possibility. In other words, this idea that people are biased is not... When you hear Paul say it, it hurts so bad because you know it's so true that you forget that the atheist really says kind of the same thing in a different context. He's saying that the theist is wicked and mad and blind because of his bias and this and that. So this isn't a foreign idea to you. The only difference is, Paul's introducing an object that you're guilty of doing the same thing to. So, since this motive of the heart is driving the mind of any man or any woman who has lived for a while, you have to turn to these other points of theology, these starting points, namely, as a sinner and as a saint. So let's start to look at this other aspect that the Bible introduces. And that has already been touched on in these verses, but now what does the Bible mean by this sin? And what does sin have? Let's keep this separate. The doctrine of sin and epistemological starting points? My goodness. I signed up for a class here on God and philosophy, not sin and gospel stuff. I feel dirty. Well, if the biblical account is true, then the sin that we are under is not a separate reality. This is the second point to this lens. If the biblical view is true, then this is the only lens we have to look at. And as I already said, the atheist believes something like this. He just makes sin into sickness and the offended party into nature, and so on. Is man searching for God? I one time heard a preacher say that the sinner can't find God for the same reason as a bank robber can't find a cop. And it's not the sort of thing that you'd be looking for under such circumstances. But our question is, what are those circumstances? One Christian philosopher, Blaise Pascal, in the 16th century, if you were to ask him, what are those circumstances that we find ourselves in, the human predicament, he would tell you that the human predicament will blow your mind because you are a human in that predicament. Duh. Don't ask about the human predicament as if it's this thing in a microscope slide. This human predicament is going to stretch your soul, as in fact you are already stretched and compromised in your approach. And so this French philosopher of all things is sort of a precursor to existentialism because he started with this paradoxical position of man, the knower and the sinner. A massive contradiction, he called man. Great and wretched. He said that man was great because he knows he's wretched. We long to be happy. We're moved only because we're doing what we're doing in order to be happy, but we never attain it. We're never able to by the nature of the case. Very depressing stuff when you actually read it. He says that we're the mind of an angel and the body of a beast. But what he's really saying here, for our question, is that human beings have two strikes against us already, not just one. We're not just skeptics. We're not just ignorant. We're not just finite. A human being is both finite and sinful. His finitude is infinitely finite, which means every truth you ever touch opens up a dozen more mysteries. And if you're not comfortable with that, that discomfort is then mixed into the equation and starts to bias your next question. Our separation from God is willful and total. And therefore, our minds are now tools in the hands of a rebel. Our minds are fallen every bit as much as the rest of our being. It's not like we have these evil emotions and evil patterns of behavior and our minds are in some shelf or some laboratory in heaven and it sees above the fray and transmits that information back to our evil being. So the biblical worldview, we're going to look at some verses in a second here, is going to teach two things that are important. Two things that are important about the doctrine of sin to our question. Number one, man himself has fallen from a favorable relationship with God to a state of hostility. Let's erase this so I can make room. Man has fallen from a favorable relationship with God to a state of hostility. When we talk about the fall, we're not talking about an impersonal fall. We're not talking about a dark forest that you were wandering as a child and now you're lost and the question is how to get home. Well, that's certainly a scrap or a part of the Christian story, but this is not an impersonal thing. The thing we've fallen from is a person. And the thing falling is a person. And having committed this treason against a person is not the same thing as searching for the question to some abstract answer. We are from a favorable relationship with God to a state of hostility. That's where we start, in our state of hostility. John 3:36 says that the person that doesn't believe in Christ has the wrath of God still abiding on him. The wrath of God is not simply something that's being stored up against you for the day of wrath, as Romans 2 says. But in fact, the wrath of God abides on you, lives on you, like a moving target that you are now. That's what you are. You're a moving target. Not only is God an infinite person, but you are a hostile person to the question. James 4:4 says that friendship with the world is enmity or warfare against God. Jesus even uses the word hate when he says no one can serve two masters, for he will either love the one and hate the other. To the degree that you love the opposite, you're cultivating a hatred of God. It's not a neutral place where you're lost. Second thing that the doctrine of sin teaches is besides the internal nature of man, there's also a personal force of evil blinding the minds of unbelievers, 2 Corinthians 4:4 says. Calls him the prince of the power of the air in Ephesians 2:1. So in addition to this reality of man, you also have this power in the universe of darkness that blinds our minds actively to the truth. Now, up until now, we've seen a handful of verses that teach that there's a darkness in the heart of man, as if it's a tender nerve that just won't go there intellectually toward God. So the picture might be of man in passivity or indecision. But I think that, from what we're seeing here, can even paint a picture which falls far short of the biblical description of the sinner's approach to God. We have to recognize that the biblical view is that the sinner's approach to God is no approach at all. It is a spiteful movement away from God. If the sinner would see God at all, it's going to be over his shoulder and through a cloud of smoke. Now, whether the student accepts this or not, this is the biblical view, and it certainly does explain why the knowledge of God could be so universal in all the earth, on the one hand, and yet so rare and faint in the minds of human beings, on the other. The substance of the knowledge is there in the universe, in the world, on the one hand, but the whole soul is handling it, not just the mind. The mind is not simply a mental computer receiving input that's disassociated from the rest of our fall. Now, remember this point, before I get to the saint, the last part, that if you find yourself weary and repulsed from seeing how this plays itself out, then you're starting to prove the point. You would be unwilling to examine a model that the world tells you is absolutely simplistic and ready for extinction. How do you usually react to fairy tales? You know, like Christianity. Humpty Dumpty. Easter Bunny. Does it tick you off? The unwillingness to look into this seems odd if the non-Christian thesis is correct. If it's really that simplistic, then the unwillingness can't be the result of intellectual difficulty. If it's a kind of irritation, then the next thing that should cross our mind is that that is the very thing the biblical view predicts. It predicts that this will be irritating. Theology, in the biblical view, within that lens, is irritating. You might say, well, biology and math is irritating too. Well, temporarily. Temporarily. But not the same kind of irritation this is. So the biblical view of God immediately and constantly exposes the heart and the horror that we feel at the sight of the biblical view of God. The scriptures talk about this in the strongest language, the language of hatred and warfare. All mankind apart from Christ are described as haters of God, Romans 1:30. Enemies of God, Romans 5:10. Children of wrath, Ephesians 2:3. When the Lord looked down from heaven to see if there's anybody who understands and who seek after God, Psalm 14:2 and 3, after he looks down to see if anybody would seek after God, it says they have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. When you look down upon the generation of Noah, it says in Genesis 6:5 that he saw that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. That's pretty universal there. Now, Christians are often afraid to embrace this idea because they think it'll lead to some kind of an us versus them mentality or a life of dismissing the unbeliever's genuine questions. In other words, it'll lead to pride or snobbery or anti-intellectualism. Well, if this is true and it's that bad, why ask the question? But I think a right understanding of this doctrine of sin should prevent these errors in two ways. So two correctives to seeing this sinful lens the right way. Number one, we were once in the same condition as the unbeliever. And in fact, we still possess the same basic nature and tendency in our souls, but for the grace of God. Theology, you may have noticed, in the church is irritating. Why? That's odd. Secondly, the proposition that all disbelief in God is ill-motivated does not imply that the intellect and information don't play a pivotal role in both directions. In other words, that bad ideas, mistakes, errors in judgment. In other words, we're not saying it's sin, it's not an error. He knows better. That's not what we're saying in some complete sense. It's both. It's error and sin. Sin and error. And conversely, when you get a sinner back going this way, when you communicate the gospel, what do you communicate it in? You communicate words, you communicate information, facts. You appeal to their intellect. God made the mind. He likes it. It's good. And when God restores a man and restores a woman, he's going to restore their mind. Last point, God to the saint. This is the briefest point because it'll be the least important in the early part of this class, although if you're a Christian, it'll be the most important thing to every part of the class and to everything else after. Every saint, now again, I'm defining a saint as a set-apart one. That's the way it's used in the Greek in Scripture. It's not a special class of Christians. It's every Christian. Every saint has a touch of the skeptic and a whole of the sinner. If what we've just said about the sinner's approach to God is true, then the saint would do well to remember that your native heart is still pumping dishonest and disdaining intellectual blood through every avenue of your soul. But the Christian has something that the non-Christian doesn't. Jesus said to his disciples when he was promising the Holy Spirit, he said in John 14:17, "You know him because he dwells with you and will be in you." So that's what the Christian, that's a pretty significant thing. You say, this is a hopeless situation. Yeah, with man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. Mark 10 says that. He was talking about, after the disciples said, well, then who can be saved? You have one thing in you. But that happens to be the one who has all the power in the universe. If God himself living inside you. That's absolutely significant. For the self-consciously converted saint, the knowledge of God takes on a whole different dimension. Theology is now three things for the Christian that it absolutely cannot be for the non-Christian. So write these down. Worship, discipleship, and sanctification. Theology for the Christian, in addition to being a thing that you ought to talk about with unbelievers, is also worship, discipleship, and sanctification. So we've defined theology at the beginning as the study of God, or the soul looking at God, the soul aiming itself and treasuring what it was made for, God. So we need to keep that total definition of theology in mind as we look at these three dimensions of the Christian life, worship, discipleship, and sanctification. First one, the knowledge of God is worship. Because knowledge is held by individual minds, and the mind was made by God for God. Remember that Jesus said that God the Father was seeking those who would worship him in spirit and truth, to relate to God as he is, as he reveals himself to be. Because of who he reveals himself to be, Jesus calls that true worship. This is what God is doing in sending his Son, he's claiming. And he says in Jeremiah 9:24, "Let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord." Paul tells the Romans to consider in Romans 12, right after the first 11 chapters of Romans, this whole big Christian worldview thing. He tells the Romans to consider these truths in the first 11 chapter and to be transformed in the mind by them. And he says in Romans 12:1, "This is your spiritual act of worship." And he goes on to talk about the renewal of your mind and so on. That's worship. And do you remember what Jesus said the greatest commandment was when he was asked that question? In Mark 12:30, he said, "To love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength." Can you fear someone that you don't know anything about? Can you love someone that you don't care to know anything about? Can you adore someone? Can you make much of someone that you don't know anything about? Will you tend to make much and more of someone that you don't want to know more about, even if you think you know enough about him? Can you honor someone who is infinite if you think you've exhausted everything there is to know about him? If you think you've scratched the surface of what there is to know about him, do you honor him? The knowledge of God is worship. Secondly, the knowledge of God makes discipleship, because a disciple is a student. And the one that the disciple follows is called the teacher. Jesus is much more than our teacher, I realize that, but he is not less than our teacher. It's the way the Gospels talk about him as the teacher. Today there's a lot of talk about being on the same mission that Jesus was on, following Jesus. And a disciple is someone who follows Jesus on his mission. Usually, these same voices will subtly and not so subtly try to convince us that there's an inverse relationship between being on mission and the teaching element of discipleship. An inverse relationship. Let's just use the word discipline, since a disciple is a disciplined one, and the sense of it in the Greek and its usage in the New Testament is of an intellectual discipline, a teacher-student relationship. The whole following thing was because Jesus had a peripatetic method of teaching. In other words, he would stroll along the way, and he would teach them things as they went along, borrowing objects of nature and stuff like that. But it was a school that Christ had them in for 3 years. And what these people tell us today is that mission and doctrine, and sometimes you'll hear, there's two models for doing church. One is to care about people and grow out there, and the other is to make us all Bible fatheads. As if the stuff in the Bible is like Pop Rocks and Kool-Aid. Maybe step up, fried chicken, French fries. The last time I checked, when the Bible talks about itself as food, it uses words like pure spiritual milk, strong meat, water for your soul, bread, the very bread of God. It's not unhealthy. It doesn't make you inactive or arrogant or things like that. Those problems lie elsewhere. When Jesus gives us the Great Commission, he describes for us what he means by making disciples of all nations, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Matthew 28:20. Jesus is telling us that to evangelize is to call disciples. And to call disciples is to teach them everything I ever taught you. This is a radically different picture than the American church today. Lastly, the knowledge of God makes sanctification. What's sanctification? That's the biblical doctrine of the believer being transformed or made more into the image of Christ every day. And that'll make you things like good for other people, but really it's at the core, it's talking about a character transformation. You're being made more holy so that you are fit to live with God. The knowledge of God makes sanctification because the soul becomes like that which it looks at. So my last diagram of the whole thing today is to look at the individual soul. Remember, you're not just a mind, a computer board out here. You're a whole soul. The soul is an intellectual thing. I know that's dirty. I know it feels dirty because of what we were taught by the church, but it ain't true. The soul is an intellectual thing. It's more than an intellectual thing, but it's not less than an intellectual thing. And what you look at is the thing that you become like. What you behold shapes you, whether it's crap on TV or whether it's an object of infinite beauty. Let me read to you two verses, one by John and one by Paul. Paul's first in 2 Corinthians 3:18. You're going to notice something in these verses that are different, and something in these two verses that are the same. 2 Corinthians 3:18. Paul says, "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into that same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." Now, I will admit, Paul is talking about something that happens gradually. Sanctification. Now, we're going to look at something that looks like a little bit different scene here at first in John's first letter, 1 John 3:2. "Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is." Now, John's talking about a different doctrine, glorification. On that day, in one day, in an instant, we will be changed, but John says, because of what we look at. So that's what's different about those two passages. Did you notice what's the same about those two passages? The transformation. So that's one thing. So in both, you have a transformation of the soul. Anything else? the object in both is the same, isn't it?
God.
Last thing, we don't just transform into something else because we look at God, but in fact, by looking at God, we become more like God. An object of infinite beauty has such a causal relationship on any other object, no matter how dark and offensive to him, that if he wants to, he can make you look at him and change your shape. So the Christian's view toward God transforms the believer into the image of God in Christ. The biblical doctrine of God isn't just the controlling factor in all of our thinking. It's more than big enough to account for all the shallow objections, all the false gods that we're going to look at in the next couple of weeks. And the Christian isn't to shy away from this. In fact, the knowledge of God isn't just a Christian mandate. Jesus calls it the very point of life itself. John 17:3, "And this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." Let me open it up to questions, and we'll talk about this whole question of approach.